just any home run. He gave up a home run in Game 5 of the 1986 American League Championship Series. His team was just about to clinch a berth in the World Series, and he gave up a home run to Dave Henderson. Ended up, his team lost that series. The Red Sox won. They went on and played the Mets, and the Red Sox had their own bad luck with Bill Buckner, if you remember that. But the fans never let Donnie Moore forget giving up that home run. Media didn't forget it, and Donnie, he didn't forget it either. On July the 18th, 1989, after an argument with his wife, he shot her 3 times in front of their children, and she survived. He went back into the house and turned the gun on himself in front of his son and took his own life. Took his own life. All his success, you know, all the things that people dreamed to achieve, he left it all behind. His daughter said that he was depressed about his career ending, and he wanted to know, what is there to show? What is there to show for my life? You know, I think a lot of people ask that question. What is left of my life? What is there to show for my life? I think it's a timeless question. If you turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, it's how Solomon begins the book. Ecclesiastes 1 verse 3, what is there to show for all the days and toil of a man's life? What is there to show? That's a question that we're going to ask ourselves tonight. When my time on this earth is done, what's there going to be? What's going to show for all the hours that I've spent on this earth? You know, this is our third session together. We covered 2 chapters the first week, chapters 1 and 2. We covered 3 chapters the second time, 3, 4, and 5. Did you get Homer's email about this chapter? It's just 12 verses. It's just 12 verses. Turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 6. If you have your Bible or have your handout. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he, for it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the one place. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after the wind. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? First 6 verses in this chapter, because I read that and I read that and I timed myself reading it, and it took me about 2 minutes, and I read it again and I read it again, and I thought, I can read all that, but what in the world is it about? You know, I mean, what is that about? I read it but I struggle to put it together. So I read it again and I read it again and again. Solomon was a smart man. He did not write an easy book to read. This is not light reading. This is not a book to read on vacation. It's deep stuff. It doesn't give headway easily. But the first six verses demonstrate what we're going to call insufficient funds. You know the old saying, I've obviously still got money in the bank. I got checks left, right? If you operate like that, then you know what insufficient funds are. Someone read verse 1 again. Read verse 1. Alan, do you have that? Will you read that?
There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is not among
them. Alan's reading from the King James. Excuse me. Preferable translation there. Other translations have, it's heavy. It's heavy. It is an intense thing. You know what it means when we say either emotionally or mentally, you know, we say that's heavy. That's heavy. It weighs on you. And now notice this, because Solomon says there's an evil I've seen under the sun. It's common to man. It lies heavy on man. Well, what is it? Solomon, tell us what it is. And notice he's actually going to give you two examples to consider. And this is interesting to me because we're doing a textual study. It's not like a topical study. You can just come in. You have to dig in to this, but I enjoy this and I hope you will as well. He says, let me give you two examples. Notice verse 2. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing, yet God doesn't give him the power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. All right, so he's been blessed with all that he could want, but this statement is added. God doesn't give him the power. Well, why can't he enjoy them? Right? It may be his health. You know, maybe his health is not sufficient that he can enjoy all the good things that he has. Or maybe he's just miserly. Miserly. Y'all remember, of course, he was a little before my time, but do y'all remember J. Paul Getty? You remember J. Paul Getty? In 1968, that's 10 years before I was born, but in 1968, J. Paul Getty was tied with Howard Hughes as the richest man in America. He had a $2 billion fortune. Billion with a B. And he soon quadrupled that $8 billion fortune. Well, one of his grandsons was kidnapped. Do you remember that story? One of his grandsons was kidnapped, but he would not ransom him. He said, I got a bunch of grandkids. And if I ransom this one, I may have to ransom all of them. Well, and maybe he didn't think the captors were serious until they cut off one of his grandson's ears and sent it back to him. We're kind of serious. And so, but he still didn't pay. They had asked for $17 million. They lowered their demand to $3 million. $3 million, you got a $2 billion fortune. You know what he did? He said, 2.2 million is as high as I'll go. 2.2. You know why 2.2? That was the maximum amount that would be tax deductible. Tax deductible. How do you think old grandson felt about grandpa? We're going to ransom you. Well, he's maybe thinking, well, my granddad's a billionaire. I mean, we'll be fine. He's not paying anything. He doesn't think we're serious. What are you doing there? Oh, hold on. 2.2 million. Well, Solomon's point is this, and this is what I would write beside if you're taking notes or if you're on the little piece of paper that I gave you. Solomon's point in these verses is this. Having doesn't equal happiness. Having doesn't equal happiness. God gives us material blessings. He's the fountain of our every blessing, but he also gives the power to enjoy them. Because Solomon goes on to say, but a stranger enjoys them. In other words, that will be somebody who's not an heir, somebody who's not in the family. This man had all this wealth, right? But he never had the opportunity to enjoy it. Now whose is it? Now whose is it? Does that remind you of any parable that Jesus told? Anything that Jesus said come to mind there? The rich fool. Here's this man that has his barns. He's got all this surplus. What will I do? I'll tear down my barns and I will do this and I will do this and I will do, I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up. Have you ever noticed, and this occurred to me the other day, have you ever noticed what happens when we start saying, I will do this, I will do this? God said, you fool, this not thy soul is required of thee. And then whose will those things be? But anytime we start putting confidence in ourselves, you know, Paul said, let he that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. I am going to heaven. How do you know? Because I come to church every time the door, I do this, I walk in the light, I am faithful, I do this, I do that. When I hear that, I'm going to tell you what I think about. You remember the parable of the Pharisee and the publican that Jesus gave? Two men stood praying, and the Pharisee said, I give tithes of all that I possess. I fast twice during the week. I do this, I do this. And he wouldn't, you know, I'm so thankful I'm not like other men, not like that publican over there, I'll tell you that. I. He told God his virtues rather than confessed his sins. But that lowly publican would not so much as lift up his eyes to heaven, but said, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. It says in our Bible it's a sinner, but the Greek article is there, the sinner. The sinner. And which one of those did Jesus say went to his house justified? The one that fasted twice in the week and gave tithes of all that he did, or the one that said, God be merciful to me, I'm a sinner? Who went to his house justified? You know who. You know who did. And I'm not saying that we can't know we're right with God. And I'm not saying that we can't know we have a home in heaven. I agree with that. You can be confident in your salvation, but it's not because of what you've done or what you're doing. It's because of the blood of Jesus Christ. And we try to be faithful. If we walk in the light as he is in the light, and I believe that and I appreciate that, but it will always be and it will ever be because of the blood of Jesus Christ. Not because I do this and I do that. Because of what God has done for you through his son, Jesus Christ. That's what we cling to. That's the cross that we cling to. Not our own deeds. At any rate, notice verse 3. That's the first example Solomon gives. The man that has all this wealth but doesn't have the power to enjoy it. Now, he gives another example that's similar, but there's a little bit of variation. Notice verse 3. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things. Now, to the first man, it said God didn't give him the power to enjoy them. Here it says his soul is not satisfied with life's good things. You have it, but you don't enjoy it. You have it, but you're still, what's the word, unfulfilled. And he pictures this man with a large family. And that's a wonderful thing. You remember what the psalmist said, Psalm 127? Happy is the man that has his quiverful of children. That was especially considered to be a double blessing from God in that society, having many children. Solomon says this man has 100 children. You know, that puts the Duggars to shame, right? The Duggars are traveling around. How many kids do they have? I quit counting at like 15. 18, 19, we won't hear no more from the Duggars. But right, don't you know McDonald's always hated to see them pull up. But at any rate, Solomon said, here's a guy that's got 100 kids, he said, but his soul was empty. Something was lacking. And notice the B part of verse 3. Also, he has no burial. Well, no wonder, you know. If you have 100 kids, you're going to be broke. You're going to be broke when you die. You won't be able to afford one. Or maybe he did this. Maybe he counted every penny. Maybe he obsessed over his wealth. And maybe he ostracized his family. Ever known people like that? So obsessed with their money that they turn that into their God. They make that their family, their friends. And maybe they didn't want to have a memorial for him. You know, maybe they didn't want to remember him. Whatever the case, the illustration's clear. Having doesn't equal happiness. Now look at verse 3, the B part. He says by way of contrast, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. Remember what Job said in his suffering, oh, I wish that I had never been born. I think the worst that I've ever heard in my life is when I had a kidney stone. And that made a show I haven't hurt much. But I remember that laying there because it was like at midnight. And I wanted to drive myself to the emergency room. But I didn't want the kid, Amanda, to wake up and be, where did Brandon go? And I didn't want to wake them up because, like I said, it was midnight to tell them, hey, I'm going, because I knew they wouldn't sleep anymore after that. So I just went and laid on the bed and thought, you know, Paul said in Acts, you know, when they were shipwrecked, they wished for the day. They were just waiting for the day to come, just waiting. And I wished for the day, that or death, swift, certain death. It hurt, you know, it hurt. I don't know what to say. It passed. It did. I mean, literally, it passed, right? But have you ever been so sick or so distraught that you said, you know what? If the Lord decided to take me right now, I'd be fine with that. I'd be fine with that. You may have felt that way. Solomon says that a miscarried child never has to go through any of that trouble and any of that unhappiness. Notice verse 5, still talking about this baby. It has not seen the sun. It has not known anything. You know, at least it didn't have to suffer, is what he's saying. In verse 6, he shifts back and talks about this man with 100 children. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. In other words, all the 2,000 years does is give him the opportunity to be miserable longer. Look at all the things he's amassed, but he can't enjoy any real lasting good. I want to move on from these 6 verses, but what I wanted to say is this. They emphasize, we said, the point of insufficient funds. And what I mean by that is just this. Material things. Material things are always going to be insufficient, lacking, right, to provide real satisfaction for your soul. And that's what he's telling us. That's what he's getting at. And he drives this home. He continues this idea in the next 3 verses. He's going to shift and talk about the insatiable appetite. Read, please. Let's read these again. 7-9. Who doesn't mind to read loudly? 7-9. All right, look at verse 7. All the toil of man is for his mouth. Why do you work? Why do you work? You know, well, at the base level, most basic level, you work for self-preservation. You work to take care of yourself. And notice the B part, yet the appetite is not satisfied. Now, this is good, and this is better than I'm going to be able to make it to be. But I want you to listen to this, because this sounds so simple on the surface. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite's not satisfied. Circle the word appetite. Make a note somewhere. It's interesting because it's the word that's usually translated soul. S-O-U-L. Nephesh. Have you ever heard a preacher say that word? I remember in preaching school hearing that. Nephesh. Genesis 1, 26 and 27, God created man and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. That's the word, nephesh. And so you could translate it like this, and this adds something to it. There's more here than just this surfacey statement. All your labor is to take care of yourself, but your soul is not satisfied. And you can might guess the appetite that's spoken of here is more than just physical hunger. You know, because you're hungry, what do? You eat. If you're thirsty, what do? You can drink something, you can suppress, or you can fulfill your body's craving for nutrition. But this need persists. We have an appetite we can't fill. Look back to Ecclesiastes 3:11. And do you know, I think Chance had a lesson on this or mentioned this in a sermon not too long ago, if I'm not mistaken. We didn't talk about this when we went over it originally. Ecclesiastes 3:11, Solomon says, God has put something into man's heart. Somebody tell me what it is. He has put what into our hearts? Eternity. God has put eternity into our heart. Well, I'm going to tell you I'm not smart enough to discourse on that, but I will tell you this. He's put eternity into our heart. Any of you ever read much by C.S. Lewis? I'm just curious. I see a hand. C.S. Lewis wrote, he's probably most famous for, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia, which are fiction. But as far as his non-fiction books go, Mere Christianity is probably his best-known book. In fact, I'm sure it is. The Weight of Glory is also another good one. C.S. Lewis, if you've ever read him, I'll tell you this. I don't care what his theme was. I find that he always wrote about the same thing. He had a lot to say about this. He called it joy, capital J, J-O-Y. It was a theme that recurs in virtually every book that he writes. And when he said joy, he didn't mean happiness exactly. Don't let your eyes glaze over here like, what in the world is he talking about? C.S. Lewis, I don't know. Listen to this. This is what Solomon's talking about. C.S. Lewis called this theme, this idea of joy, he called it a desire which no natural happiness can satisfy. He said, in fact, it was a longing for something that cannot be fulfilled in this life. And listen to his point. This is how he illustrated it. I think this is good. I think you will too. He said, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exist. In other words, there's no such thing as desires if the potential fulfillment for that desire doesn't exist. He said, for example, a baby feels hunger. Well, there is such a thing as food. He said, a duckling wants to swim. He said, well, there is such a thing as water. Now he made his point. He said, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, he says the most logical explanation is that I was made for another world. Now let that sink into your ears. If you have a desire, there must be the potential for that desire to be. It doesn't mean that it will be. He said a man may be out in a raft in the middle of the sea and he's starving to death and he might not get food. But he said the fact that he's hungry proves that he's from a race that sustains itself with food. He says, I wish I believed. He said, the fact that I desire heaven means that I will go there. He said, I know the fact just that I want to go there doesn't mean that I will, but he says that does mean there is a place and that some people will. You have a desire. Solomon said you have a desire in your soul that no earthly thing can satisfy. God put eternity in your heart, a longing for Him if we recognize it. And that's the key. So many people have that stab, that pain, that longing, and they look for other things to fulfill it instead of looking to the God who put that into their hearts, according to Ecclesiastes 3:11. So the point is just this. We'll get back to the text. Everybody, regardless of their circumstances, has a desire that food can't fill. And that's why you can give all these examples of millionaires who are miserable, right, and unhappy, that just because they have money doesn't make them happy. Look at verse 9, the A part. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. In other words, it's better to be content with what you have than always wanting more and more and more. How would we say it? What's the, a bird in the, I didn't understand what that meant growing up. A bird in the hand, right? Two in the bush. I had no idea what that meant when I was growing up. What is a bird in the hand? Two in the bush? But I get it now. The bird you got is better than the two you don't got. But there's two out there in the bush. You got one in your hand. Be content with it. So he's saying you're going to be miserable if you just look for something more or something different all the time doing that. But even with contentment, there's still within your heart an insatiable appetite that material things can't satisfy. If we'll just open our eyes to that, and so many people don't, they just dredge themselves deeper and deeper into material pursuits. He says that's vanity and it's a striving after the wind. Now, notice the last section here. Verses 10 through 12. Will someone read that? We'll close this out with these three verses. Look at verse 10. Whatever has come to be has already been named. It is known what man is. Now, this is the part I wanted to look at. And that he is not able to dispute with one who's stronger than he. And again, this is intended to make us think. This isn't something to just read over and pass on as light reading. And that's where I get frustrated sometimes. I like for things to be right on the surface. Let me read this and it's apparent. And I figure it out and I move on. I get impatient if you having to dig through these things, but that's where I think the nuggets are. Solomon says, in other words, as long as you're trying to provide your own happiness, as long as you are ignoring the one who is mightier than you, the more you're just going to increase despair, the more you're just going to increase confusion, the more you're going to increase absurdity in your life. Look at verse 12. For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which pass as a shadow. The idea here is, who knows what that missing ingredient is in order to have this good for your soul. Look at the B part. For who can tell man? Who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? And the idea here is the future, not the afterlife. Not talking about heaven or hell here. The key is under the sun. And here's what he says. Solomon says we ought to have a little bit of humility. We ought to have a little bit of humility and look to God for meaning and for purpose and for the answers to these questions that plague us, because we don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. Who said that in the New Testament? Right? Go to now, ye that say today or tomorrow will go into such a city, continue there a year, buy, sell, get gain. You don't know what will be tomorrow. James said, James 4:14. Now, look back to chapter 3. Because Solomon says, you think you have it all figured out. You don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. You have no way to know and plan and prepare for every contingency. But here's the point. His point is that life is this way because there is an unalterable or inalterable decree. In other words, God made it this way. This is how God made life. Remember how chapter 3 starts out? To everything there is a purpose. There is a time for everything under heaven. He says there is a time for everything in that sense. You know, God gives you the ability to work, to receive enjoyment, even to enjoy more than you need to survive. But, and this is the key to the whole thing we've said tonight, but God has also, in creating these things, fixed this idea. You can't find happiness without me. That's the key. You can't find happiness without God. You know, you may find contentment relatively speaking, you may find contentment. You might distract yourself as you go about this life in some type of routine. But listen to this. When you get down to the nitty gritty, right, when you get down to asking yourself about the heavy things that really matter in life, you're going to come up empty if you try to answer these questions on your own. And that's the key. We talked about reading this book and how at times it seems like people say this is a very pessimistic book. This is a very, you know, discouraging book. It is not. But you have to understand the point of view that Solomon writes as a narrator, not as himself per se always, maybe switches voices back and forth, right? But imagine going through life as this individual, and this is the person that he's talking about, trying to find happiness, trying to find answers without looking to God. and trying to figure it out. Remember what he said? If you look at nature and try to figure out this, your eyes and your ears are going to strain. If you try to think about philosophy, it's just going to make you tired. Much study is weariness of the flesh. And he's building as we go along. He's putting this book together just like bricks, you know, in a wall or pieces in a puzzle. And when we get to the end, he's going to tell us this secret, but he actually doesn't wait till the end before he tells us. He reveals it a little bit, a little bit, a little bit along as he goes. Now, listen to this and see what you think. Listen to this and see what you think. This is one last quote from C.S. Lewis. This is from his book, Mere Christianity. Suppose somebody said, look, I just want to be happy. I don't want any of this God business. I just want to be happy in my own way. I don't want to worry about religion. I don't want to fuss with church. I just want to be happy. All right? I think a lot of people live that way. But listen to what C.S. Lewis said. When I read this, I underlined it about 8 times with my little highlighter, I think. That is why it is just no good asking God to make us happy in our own way without bothering about religion, without bothering, we would say, about Christianity. Now listen to this. God cannot give us happiness and peace apart from himself because it is not there. There is no such thing. Isn't that good? Isn't that good? He says, you can't ask God, I don't want to worry with all this. I just want to be happy in my life. I just want to be so happy. You can't have happiness without God. There are just no such thing. Oh, relative contentment, you're deceived. Sure, but true happiness, you can't have it without God. That's because why? That's what we're talking about in these last 3 verses. Because that's the way God made it. That's the way it is. That's, you know, long before Walter Cronkite said it, right? Solomon said it. That's the way it is. Think about the insufficient funds. Material things are never going to satisfy your soul. Right? Why? Because you've got an appetite. God put eternity into your heart. You're always going to crave for something other than food. Every one of us, no matter rich or poor, no matter whatever your circumstances may be. Why? Because that's the way it is. God made this world and God made you. I'm going to tell you what. I think this is a remarkable book. A remarkable book. And it's not one, like I say, there's some books that are just narrative and you sit down and you can read this one time. Okay, Moses went up the mountain and Moses came back down the mountain. Okay, I think I got that. This is not a book that you can just read one time like, oh yeah, got it. I'm good to go. I have to read it 5 times before I realize that I'm confused. Then you read it again, you read it again, and you read it again. But I think it's worth it. To me, and I'll tell you the truth, to me this was the hardest chapter that we've looked at so far. Right? I'm excited about, I personally enjoy chapter 7 a little better than chapter 6. But then I thought, no, you know what? There's rewards here. There's rewards here if you dig into this and see what he's really saying to you. Look to God. Look to God for the answers to your question. And I look forward. I'm done tonight. I'm not going filibuster. I'm enjoying this book and I hope you're enjoying this study as well. Looking forward to concluding this over the next. We're not going to spend an entire quarter on it. We'll spend, I've got us being done with this mid-November. Mid-November, and then we'll move on. But I hope you're enjoying this. I certainly am. Thank you very much for your attention tonight.